This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Dan Carden is the chief political reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and he is joining us on the program today to bring us up to date on the stories that he's put out there in print and online. And as always, Dan, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start first with a couple of the stories that you have out. One of them, the most recent one here, brings us up to date, and both of these are involving federal issues, that is to say, the impeachment vote in the U.S. House of Representatives, and also the impact that the, I suppose you could say, the upcoming inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden might have on the State House in Indianapolis. Bring us up to date first, if you will, on the story about the vote that was taken in the House yesterday and where Indiana's congressional delegation stood.
Yeah, I'm sure all of your listeners know, President Trump was impeached for a second time yesterday. The House claims, the House impeachment documents say that Trump incited the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, for which they were impeaching him after almost a year ago they impeached him for abuse of power. So they're impeaching him for inciting the attack. And the House delegation from Indiana has 9 members, 2 Democrats, both of whom voted for the impeachment, 7 Republicans, all of whom voted against the impeachment. It was the same split on the last impeachment vote in 2020, even though there were different members. We have the new Democratic congressman from Northwest Indiana, Frank Mervan, who replaced Pete Viscovsky just 10 days ago on January 3rd. He's had a very interesting tenure as a member of Congress. He was sworn in last Sunday. Capitol was attacked last Wednesday. 1 week later, he's voting to impeach the president. Some congressmen go their entire careers never getting to vote for an impeachment, and Frank Mervan did it in his first 10 days.
And you have in your story, too, that was also Frank's 17th vote since he took office from Pete Viscovsky. So that's early, too, when you think about even of course, such a historic vote. It was only the 17th when Frank Mervan cast that vote, as compared to all of the years that Pete Viscovsky, although he's had some momentous votes, I'm sure, over the years, right, but not like this.
Right. And Pete had 2 impeachments. He voted for President Trump's impeachment last year, and President Clinton voted against President Clinton's in 1998. But yeah, I imagine it's been quite a 2 weeks for Frank Mervan to be in Washington and see, you want to start this whole congressional career, this tenure in federal office, do things for your district, and there's a mob of angry Trump supporters coming at you one day, and you're voting to impeach the president a week later.
Yeah, you have the story, too, in recent issues of the Times as to what Congressman Mervan had to say, his reaction to everything that happened, as he was a witness to all of that last week as well, too.
Right.
Tell us now, is the situation that I guess the State House officials as well as law enforcement are going to have to be prepared for just in case something nasty happens in Indianapolis during the inauguration next week?
Yeah, this is an FBI warning that came out the past couple of days, warning that armed protests are being planned at all 50 state capitals starting Saturday and running through the inauguration on January 20th, and then also at the U.S. Capitol in an attempt to disrupt the inauguration. There's been reports on Lakeshore Public Radio, on TV, of all these National Guard soldiers going to the Capitol in Washington to protect it during the inauguration to make sure President-elect Joe Biden is sworn in, nobody gets hurt, there's no protests or riots or anything like we saw last week. There are, including 625 Indiana National Guardsmen who have been deployed to Washington during the inauguration period to assist their fellow guardsmen from across the country and making sure there is a peaceful transition of power at the federal level. At the state level, though, there are also state police, Indianapolis Metropolitan Police, other law enforcement and Homeland Security agencies at the local, state, and federal level are making plans to prepare for anything that might happen at the Indiana State House. It wouldn't make much sense from a logistical point of view. If you're angry about Trump losing, you wouldn't theoretically attack Indiana, which voted for Trump and you know, the Indiana State House is filled with a lot of Trump supporters serving in the General Assembly, but, you know, there's a lot of Republicans in Congress, too, and those people, you know, attacked all of them last week as well. So they say they're prepared for whatever comes along. There is a long tradition of peaceful protests in Indiana. You saw 10 years ago, you know, there are tens of thousands of people inside the State House and outside the State House for the right to work protests. Just last year, we saw or in 2019, we saw the Red for Ed teacher protests seeking higher pay. That brought thousands of people to the State House lawn in an entirely peaceful event. So Indiana doesn't really have this sort of tradition of political violence, but you know, it better to be prepared, I think, is what these law enforcement agencies are.
And I know you mentioned in your story too about the fact that besides having the state police and the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police around, that there wasn't any real concern, at least to the governor, of having to call the Indiana National Guard to come down to the State House. And on top of that, the State House is a kind of a quiet place these days anyway because of the coronavirus pandemic. And you mentioned last time we talked was the fact that everybody had to kind of split up and go to different places, that they had to put people into the Indiana Government Center South and other buildings as well as the State House to be able to accommodate everybody to do the social distancing they have to do this time.
That's right. Yeah, so they're not even letting the public into the House and Senate chambers to watch what goes on. Normally there's seating in a balcony over the House and Senate, and that space is, well, the House isn't even meeting in the House. They're meeting in a conference center that can enable everybody to spread out, and there's no public access to that room. And then the Senate is spaced out, has 30 of its members on the Senate floor and 20 more in the balcony. So there's no public access to the Senate either. They're just telling people to watch online if they want to monitor what's going on in the chambers. So there is a process where people can go into the State House to testify for or against legislation that's pending in committees, but there really isn't that sort of gathering space like there usually is. And they're really encouraging people to just stay away until they get through the COVID pandemic and on to the other side when enough people have been vaccinated that, we can resume, what used to be a normal life.
I know that some of the stories that you've already put out in the Times talking about the General Assembly session deal with topics like we've talked briefly about this in our last conversation before the session really got started, is about the governor's budget, the two-year state budget that lawmakers are going to have to pass before they can leave the session at the spring. And also some other topics, too. Let's talk first here about the governor and how he's feeling about the budget and he's presented to lawmakers.
Yeah, that actually, I thought that was going to be the most important story yesterday.
And yeah.
It became like the seventh most important story.
Well, things happen like that.
Exactly. Indiana and every state really took a hit last year due to the COVID-19 shutdowns. A lot of people temporarily lost their jobs, went on unemployment. In Indiana, a lot of those people have gotten their jobs back, but there were also a couple months where most of the stores were closed, so nobody was buying things at brick-and-mortar retailers. There was a lot of online business, and you have to pay sales tax on that, but there was just some degree of lost business, and then also the casinos were shut down for 3 months, which you can't get any of that money back. So Indiana lost about $600 to $800 million in revenue last year, and it's gotten some of it back, but not all of it.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the lost revenue didn't end up being as bad as everybody initially thought it was going to be, in part because Governor Holcomb ordered state agencies to cut their spending by 15% immediately, and basically made that the new base amount for each state agency. So Indiana implemented some pretty rigorous cost-cutting moves ahead of a lot of other states, plus Indiana has a huge budget surplus. So going into this new budget that legislators are going to create this year, Indiana's isn't in such bad shape as everybody initially feared. The unemployment rate is coming down. People are, buying things again, earning incomes, paying sales tax. And So there is some money there. Governor Holcomb is basically going to, his budget proposes taking all the new money and putting it into education funding.
Yeah.
It's not as much as it was in prior years, but it's better than nothing is kind of the argument they're making. And then taking whatever savings they've gotten from the state agency reductions and some other spendings and putting more of that toward positioning Indiana to be in better financial shape in the years ahead by paying off some outstanding debts, paying down some obligations to a teacher pension account, and kind of positioning Indiana maybe for the 24-25 budget to be in a much better position than it is right now.
And one of the other stories that came out of the General Assembly here in recent days comes out of Northwest Indiana, of course, too. We're talking about the efforts that State Senator Eddie Melton of Gary is doing. He's leading the banner, carrying the banner for a little higher minimum wage, hopefully, that will get passed. It's hard to believe it's been 12 years since the last minimum wage increase came about, but I guess so.
Yeah. People making the minimum wage haven't gotten a raise in more than a decade. It's $7.25 per hour, exactly where it was in 2009 when the federal government increased the minimum wage, and then of course Indiana had to follow because Indiana's not, you know, states aren't allowed to have a lower minimum wage than the federal one, but can certainly have a higher minimum wage than the federal one. A lot of our neighboring states have increased the minimum wage. And there's this whole fight for 15 movement to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour that some states are moving toward. But even if you just adjusted the minimum wage for inflation over the past 12 years, it should be at $8.64 an hour instead of $7.25 per hour. So that's where Senator Melton's coming from, that, you know, some of these, you know, individuals earning the minimum wage and a lot of these are, you know, what they call essential jobs, people who kept working during the pandemic, grocery store clerks, delivery drivers, you know, a lot of people who are a lot of that everybody else relies on, you know, are still making this low rate of pay compared to our neighboring states and just, you know, a hard amount to live on. So Senator Melton is proposing is to increase the minimum wage to $10 an hour right away and then by $1 each year until we get to $15 an hour in 2027.
Mm-hmm. As I recall, and you probably do too, that this topic has come up before, and I know that in your story you mentioned, the quote mentions from Melton says, quote, "I truly believe that Indiana can and should do better." That was, I'm sure, taken from when Senator Melton was a gubernatorial candidate not so many years ago. He talked about this topic then on one of his platform planks was to help raise Indiana's minimum wage so that more people in Indiana had a better chance of surviving.
Yeah, this has actually been a major issue for Democrats, especially Northwest Indiana Democrats, who see people going across the state line to make more money in Illinois. You know, for years, 12 years is a long time to not get a pay raise. I mean, that's like newspaper industry life. But so this has been a priority for him. The problem is, it's not a priority for the Republicans, and the Republicans control the governor's office. The Republicans control the House and the Senate. Governor Holcomb, in particular, has said that, you know, he understands the push for a minimum wage, but he's looking at it from an entirely different perspective. He's saying, if you're in a minimum wage job, the state right now has free programs to train you for a better job that pays well above the minimum wage, and he would rather encourage people to do that and help people, you know, skill up for these higher paying jobs than to focus on increasing the minimum wage.
Well, Dan, we'll have to leave it at that, and we have more to cover, and there'll be more to talk about next time as the General Assembly continues its work here. And we thank you for spending time with us today to talk about it.
Anytime.
Dan Carton is the chief political reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. You're listening to Regionally Speaking. General Assembly is in session in Indianapolis, and besides dealing with a two-year state budget and other issues, and some of them dealing with, the coronavirus pandemic, there are always environmental issues that come up. Let's find out what is on the environmental agenda for the Hoosier Environmental Council. We have with us Jesse Carbonda. He's executive director of the HEC. And Jesse, thanks for joining us on the show today.
So good to be with you, Chris. Thank you.
There's so many things that can always come up as far as helping improve Indiana's environment and other related issues. And bring us up to date on some of the major projects that are at least being kept an eye on by the AGC. I know in particular, in fact, we've had a conversation with Dr. Indra Frank about this, about coal ash disposal. Tell us about in more detail about the bills that the AGC is watching about that.
Sure. And, you know, what's interesting, Chris, is that many of the bills that are of our top priority are bills that are actually sponsored by lawmakers in Northwest Indiana. And with respect to coal ash, these two bills are geared towards the same concern, which is that there's a lot of coal ash that lies in floodplains across Indiana. And furthermore, the vast majority, in fact, 9 out of 10 sites in Indiana have had contamination of their groundwater that's located beneath these coal ash sites. And the problem is that the coal ash is toxic. It consists of a variety of different toxic metals that at a certain level could be devastating to our drinking water. And so both the bills in the House and the Senate, the House bill being sponsored by Representative Boy, and the Senate bill being sponsored by Senator Tellian, both, of course, Northwest Indiana lawmakers, would forbid coal ash from being permanently stored in either floodplains or in situations where they've contaminated groundwater.
Are there any other issues that are up before the lawmakers this time around that deal specifically with environmental problems?
Absolutely. There's several, actually. One bill that's going to be heard today, January 13th at 3:30, p.m. Eastern Time, would be a bill called HB 1191. And what it does, Chris, is it forbids cities and counties from passing a ban against certain types of energy resources. And the context here is that the legislature has, year after year, either passed bills or considered bills that attempt to weaken or really strip the power of local governments to carry out very important functions. And this bill is of great concern to us because it has the practical effect of potentially preventing a city or county across Indiana, including Northwest Indiana, from, say, forbidding a waste-to-energy facility from being built in their in the jurisdictional boundaries of the county or city. So again, if a city or county were to decide from the standpoint of their public health officials or experts that are advising the city council or county council that this is a wrong thing to have in the community, they would be barred from putting a prohibition on that waste energy resource from being built in that community. So we're going to testify in opposition to that bill, HB 1191, and we hope that folks who are listening in will urge their state representative to oppose this bill.
And certainly, we should mention here that even though they do come up in committee meetings, that's just one of the steps along the way, and eventually it'll either come out of committee and get taken care of by the full Indiana House or the Indiana Senate or both. I guess it's worth keeping an eye on. They don't go away if they happen to go to committee and have a hearing there too. What other major issues that are on the environmental agenda that lawmakers are likely to look at and you all at the Hoosier Environmental Council are looking at too?
Absolutely. You know, another priority for us is the IDEM budget, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management budget. The concern there, Chris, is that the size of the workforce has gone down by one-fifth over the last 10 years, even if the economy and population have grown over that period of time. So that means that we have less people that are inspecting polluting facilities. We've got less people that are writing permits and making sure that those permits are written in a stringent way so that the public health is protected. It means less people that would be holding these polluters accountable. So we're very concerned about the reduction in workforce, and we want to prevent any cuts to IDEM this budget session. We know it's a tough one because the COVID pandemic has certainly affected tax revenues of all kinds, but we think that there's a special obligation for the General Assembly to safeguard the budget of IDEM because anything that makes people more vulnerable to the pandemic ought to have greater priority on the part of state government funding. And, of course, if people are exposed to different types of particulate matter or toxins that affect their respiratory health, that makes them more vulnerable to COVID. You know, I should also mention, Chris, and we may need to talk about it in another conversation, if there's an array of solar bills that are coming up that will make rooftop solar more affordable and accessible. Several of those are being sponsored by Republicans. So this is an encouraging trend to see bipartisan support for rooftop solar.
I know we've talked about this in the past, and I haven't seen much that has come out, and I'm not sure if there is anything that's on the docket for the lawmakers to deal with this legislative session, but I know there's been great concern in recent years about being able to recycle materials that should be put to good use instead of thrown into the landfill or the incinerator, depending on which community you happen to live in. Are there any measures that you're aware of coming up, or ones that the Hoosier Environmental Council is interested in making sure get taken into account that are dealing with solid waste disposal in particular, helping people recycle better and recycle more?
You know, a lot of the momentum, Chris, related to recycling has happened at the city level, largely because funding has been so tight. In fact, the technical assistance arm of IDEM has particularly borne a cut in their funding, according to a study by the Environmental Integrity Project. So a lot of the momentum around making sure that we have true recycling programs or composting programs has been at the city level. So, for example, Indianapolis, our capital city, has committed to doing a careful review of its recycling program such that when the contracts end with the current recycling providers in 2025, there will be a commitment to essentially aim for curbside recycling for all in Indianapolis. And I know that other municipalities across the state are kind of rethinking their recycling programs in the context of the expiration of their existing contracts.
I know there's concern, and you brought it up too, Bob, with the fact having to watch what lawmakers do in putting together the next two-year state budget on how they keep the Indiana Department of Environmental Management funded. And we know that IDEM does provide, as you've just mentioned, some of the incentive programs and that will help organizations and communities better recycle. So you wonder if the funding still has to be boosted for IDEM if they don't get them enough money that they're going to cut the programs or cut them back even more.
Right. You know, there's a case to actually increase funding, not just prevent cuts to funding, but increasing funding. For example, the average person who is handling the management of toxic waste sites has a workload of about 40 sites per person, per employee, which is more than the other states that we've looked into. And that means that a community that is worried about the public health harm of a toxic site in their community has to essentially wait extremely patiently to see that site be cleaned up, be remediated. And that's, of course, a great concern if you've got school kids that might be playing around there, or if you've got people who have weak immunity systems, to be in a situation where, again, there's a slow process for cleaning up these sites simply because IDEM's staffing is too limited. You know, another very practical example that has great bearing in Northwest Indiana is that we know that the Office of Air Quality within IDEM is short-staffed.
Right.
And that means that there are less inspectors to look at polluting facilities. It means that there are less people that can write permits to, you know, carefully ensure that a given polluting facility is subject to all the federal and state regulations so that the public health is protected. So there's very practical reasons why we need to not only protect IDEM funding, but try to boost funding.
Now, if any of our listeners are interested in keeping track of what the legislators do concerning the environment, this current session of the legislature, where can they find out more?
The best two sources are hecweb.org, which is our website. If you go there, you'll see BillWatch 2021, where we diligently track a number of different bills. And then also facebook.com/HECWEB, H-E-C-W-E-B. where we provide real-time updates about what's happening in the General Assembly.
Jesse Carbonda, thanks for being with us and bringing us this latest legislative update, watching the environment for the from the Hoosier Environmental Council.
Our pleasure, Chris, and look forward to the next conversation.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Coming up on Monday, January 18th, beginning at noon until 2 p.m., is going to be a virtual presentation on what is called Culturally Relevant and Responsive Pedagogy, or CRP. It's a very long title for a topic that teachers and administrators of schools and parents and other stakeholders in the school community should check out. And it's going to be presented by our next guest on Regionally Speaking. Montia Gardner is a doctoral candidate at the University of Maryland in Baltimore County. She has links to Indiana, though. She's been the president of the Children's Reading Foundation of Greater Indiana and a lot of other things in the Midwest as well. And she is joining us to talk about her presentation coming up here. And, Montia, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Will you please take a moment and explain what CRP is really all about, and in particular, how it's very important for teachers as well as other people that help students be able to help deal with the pandemic that we are now in?
Culturally relevant or culturally responsive pedagogy is a term that was coined in 1995 by a scholar named Gloria Ladson Billings. And what she talked about is engaging learners whose experiences and cultures are traditionally excluded from the mainstream setting. And what she believed is that it would, that teaching in this manner would include and yield academic success, that teaching must help students develop positive ethnic and cultural identities while simultaneously helping them to achieve academically. And third, by teaching them that must support the student's ability to recognize and understand and critique the current and social inequalities that are currently going on in the world. Mm-hmm. So I know that that's a mouthful of about what teachers do, but if you would really let me be honest, I will tell you that all good teachers probably are currently organically being culturally responsive, and this is sort of a way to categorize and put a name to what is already happening in the classroom in so many different cases.
Are we finding that in addition to this, that we're also trying to find better ways to teach diversity?
Well, absolutely. Diversity is a major part of what's happening in the amalgamation of education right now in America. As you can see, we're apart now because everybody's home virtually, but there are things happening in every part of the world culturally that impact how students are learning today. The way they learn in English, in math, in physics, in science, it is all being culturally expanded and internationally expanded to meet their needs if a teacher knows how to incorporate those basic tenets into their curriculum and instruction.
Okay. Let's talk first about what teachers can get out of this virtual presentation coming up here. And you talk about the tenets of CRP. What can you hope that teachers will learn from this? You mentioned that they're kind of organically, in many respects, in a way, learning and helping provide these tenets, but they probably need a little help along the way, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. So one of the things that you asked about is how other people in the community can be involved. And mm-hmm. So this is where teachers benefit. Because what is needed most desperately right now is the training in culturally responsive pedagogy and teaching, because as easy as it sounds to incorporate in curriculum and instruction, it is really that much more difficult to be intentional about the work. And so what has to happen now is stakeholders in the community have to support teachers, parents, and students by possibly funding workshops or bringing people in who know or are experts in the field to help school districts and teachers become more culturally responsive in their curriculum and actually use their own funds of knowledge about education to help them to develop curriculums that can be widespread across the country.
Now, how can parents take advantage of learning CRP to be able to help their students or their family members?
So parents get a chance to then be accountable for knowing what their children are supposed to learn and how diverse the curriculum is supposed to be. So this gives parents an opportunity to be ever vigilant in holding teachers accountable for that diverse curriculum and making sure to know what they're looking for when they're assessing how culturally responsive a teacher is being in that particular subject area.
How easy if CRP is used to be able to help put in more opportunities for making students feel more confident, be more positive as they're trying to learn something?
Well, I can attest to culturally responsive pedagogy way before the term was ever coined. Uh-huh. As you know, I am a native of the Northwest Indiana area. As a matter of fact, I am a product of the Gary Community School Corporation. I graduated from Lew Wallace High School as an undergraduate in 1998. I went on from there to DePauw University, and that's where I received my bachelor's degree in secondary education. But where my beginning started was at a little school over on the east side of Gary called Williams Elementary School. And when I became a fifth grader there in 1989, of sorts, I saw in that school myself represented in my teachers. My principal had a PhD, which I at the time did not quite understand what that meant, but eventually, I was led to understand that that was the highest level you could of attainment you could get in education. My teachers focused desperately on our personal academic achievement, and it was all done in a way that was culturally responsive to my needs, allowing me to express both my voice and my talent and my intellect. So when I became a doctoral student, that's the first time I was able to actually put a name to what had been a part of my existence all my life. And I would bet that the Gary Community School Corporation is still educating children in this manner and probably just need to be even more intentional about making that a positive focus of urban education.
Now, this program is coming up on Monday, the 18th. It begins at noon, runs for 2 hours. How can folks get signed up for the virtual conversation if they're interested to participate? First, just to check it out.
Well, first of all, I would love for you to join my Facebook page at Montia Dene, where you can find the link to the culturally responsive workshop. Mm-hmm. The fee is $24.99, and that is to help with the dissemination of information that I'm going to receive, that the people who participate will receive articles and such information as that. You can also visit me directly and contact me at MontiaDene@gmail.com. That's capital MONTIA, capital DENEE at gmail.com. And I can forward you information. If you would like to message me on either Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, I am available to receive those messaging and forward the link to you as well. And I would love for the whole community to participate. It would be my pleasure.
Well, and certainly too for teachers, they can benefit professionally, I understand. They get some benefit out of it directly, don't they?
Yes, they do. So I did this workshop. I conducted this workshop last year about this time, and the Gary Community School Corporation offered if once they receive the certificate, all they would have to do is have it signed by their principal, and they could receive 2 CPUs towards their teacher licensure.
Well, Montia, thank you very much for explaining what culturally relevant and responsive pedagogy, and you'll learn more if you participate in the virtual conversation coming up on Monday, January 18th. Thank you for explaining things for us, and we hope that many people here in Northwest Indiana take advantage of this opportunity to learn something that will be of benefit not only to themselves as teachers and stakeholders in the community, but also to young people as well, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and have a great day.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. On Monday, we have a special program on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and Regionally Speaking is back on Tuesday.